My name's Cricket. I'm an alcoholic. Albert already told you that in Texas we tell you how long we've been sober. My sobriety date is October the 19th of 1969. And we don't tell you that to brag. We tell you that to tell you that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works one day at a time in spite of anything that comes down the road. The one thing I've done right for 23 years is I haven't taken a drink of anything containing alcohol. No near beer, no close to it, none of that stuff, you know. Sorry, but that's the way I was taught, is if it's got a little alcohol, it's got alcohol, we practice absolute abstinence. I'm grateful that the only thing I had to do in the fellowship was to not take that first drink, because I would have flunked out of Alcoholics Anonymous my first 23 years, because Fred asked me this morning about making amends to somebody. I said, I haven't been sober long enough to be willing to make amends to her. I'm not that well yet. I'm not sure I'm through getting there. Milt started me off in a funny spot because it's hard to make a woman like me blush, but there's some men that have an uncanny ability. And I guess it's a gift or a plague that he has, but the things he wanted to do with this beautiful corsage, you wouldn't believe. And then he's telling me I left my slippers in his room. I didn't. I wasn't there. But it was kind of funny, but I did get embarrassed. The big book tells me, and my sponsor told me, to share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I don't know if I was born alcoholic. I don't care. I think I became alcoholic because when nothing else worked for me, alcohol could kill me. When nothing else worked, it didn't matter if my family was or my great-grandfather. I'm the only one in my family that I'm aware of. I was born into a family. My mother's full-blooded Black Irish and my father was full-blooded Frenchman. I never met my father, but I know two things about him. He sired 17 children, so I know he was a very potent man. And none of us met him, so I know that he knew how not to plant roots anywhere. My mother was very, very superstitious. She believes that one child in every family, even in the generations coming up now, are born bad. And you determine that child by their weight at birth. A child that weighs the least is born evil. They're born possessed, and I weighed 2.5 pounds when I was born. So I was evil. I was possessed. I earned that reputation after a while. My mother and father didn't see each other, and my mother married a man. And the way we made our living, he was a neat guy. He had a third grade education. And we made our living back in the early 40s following crops all over the United States. And that was such a neat way of life. We got to go someplace new all the time. And we got to pick fruits and we got to pick vegetables. And there's something so clean about dirt that unless you've actually done it, you don't understand what I'm talking about. Dirt can be so warm when you're cold, and it can be so cool when you're hot. And, you know, picking things fresh off of a vine, there's just something that's magical, absolutely magical about that kind of lifestyle. The only thing I did not like about following crops was that each time the fruit or vegetable season changed, we had to move. And each time we moved, society said that we had to go to school. And I do. I have 4 years of formal education. And each school we went to, it seemed as if I was too tall for the other children to play with me. I was too short. I was too fat. Or I was too thin. We didn't have indoor water. We didn't have indoor electricity. And we weren't very clean on the outside of our bodies. We took a bath once a week. And we took it in a galvanized round tub in the middle of the kitchen floor. And it was kind of a neat deal. They don't change the water after each child, see? They used to catch water in a rain barrel outside with a rag close-pinned across the top to filter out whatever pollution there was back then. It worked. It was a lot cheaper than what they're trying to do now. It filtered out the stuff that we're not supposed to have. We'd take a bucket, we'd heat it on the wood stove, we'd pour it in this big round tub, and just like a litter of puppies, one at a time, we'd get in there. Well, I'm the last kid. I'm the run of that litter. And I get in after all these other dirty children have been in there. They pour in another bucket of warm water, and I'm supposed to come out clean? Not yet. But I liked that. These children were afraid. Their parents were afraid. The children weren't afraid. Because we didn't have the proper facilities, we had real bad skin. And we had dirty, tangly hair. And we had real bad teeth. And parents believed and told their children that we were gypsies. It's two different cultures. It's two different lifestyles. They were afraid that we would steal their children. 17? Uh-uh. Your money? Yeah, we'd steal your money, your jewelry. Your kids were safe. I've never seen a child fall on crops as cute as a parent thought it was. Never. There was just never a child that adorable that it was worth taking on. So they weren't allowed to associate with us. And I was raised in the type of family that it was not, it was just my family. But it wasn't the type of family where you were safe. I don't know any other way to describe it. When the sun goes down and kids come running in the house in the evening, they're supposed to feel a feeling of safe. They're supposed to smell a smell of safe. They're supposed to have a touch of safe. We went outside when the sun went down. We didn't know what was outside, but we knew what was inside. And I had to find a safe place. And I found a safe place in my house. And it was behind the wood stove. See, I could crawl up behind the wood stove, and there's usually only room for one. And I could sit behind that stove, and I could close my eyes, and I could close my heart, and I could pretend. And I pretended that my hair was a different color. And I pretended that my eyes were a different color. And I pretended that I was just tall enough, that I weighed enough, that I had pretty teeth and skin. And I pretended that you let your daughter say hi to me. I pretended that you weren't afraid to touch me. Because see, what I was wasn't contagious. And I'd pretend. Some of my brothers had become armed robbers at this time in my life. And they came behind my hiding place. And they made a hole in the wall. And they hid their guns and they hid their money in my hiding place. And in exchange for me not telling on them, they brought me a gift. And they brought it in a brown paper sack. And it was my first introduction to alcohol. And it was whiskey. And I was 12 years old. And I sit behind that stove, and my first drink of whiskey was as much and in the same manner as to this date, my last drink. And if I ever resume drinking, I'm sure it will be the same way. I took the lid off the bottle, and I held it up to my lips, and I started drinking it. And I never will forget. That whiskey burned my throat. It burned my chest. It burned all the way down my fingertips, all the way down to my stomach, and it burned all the way back up again. And it burned all the way back down again, and it burned, and I kept drinking until the bottle was empty. The neat thing that happened with that whiskey was that I quit pretending. I went before this elusive thing called a God that crop followers heard about, and we heard about God twice a year, and we heard about God through a man behind a podium that would say something to the effect of, anything you ask for in the name of Jesus, you'll receive it. That's what I heard. I don't think that's what the man meant for me to hear. Because, see, what I wanted more than anything in the world was clear skin. And so when I went home and I went to the mirror and I put my finger on a spot that didn't have a zit and I looked in there and I believed, I truly believed, and I said, in the name of Jesus, when I get up in the morning, make the rest of my face as clear as this spot is right here. And when I woke up in the morning, I was excited. My heart beat fast. And I went to the mirror because I really thought, I'll have clear skin. And there was a pimple right where I prayed. So I knew this Jesus didn't like me. The man did not know what I heard. His words may very well be true, but he didn't know what I heard. And I went before this God after I was introduced to whiskey. And I said something to the effect of, Dear God, sir, my name's Cricket, and I don't really believe in you, and I don't believe in family, and I don't believe in cleanliness, and I don't believe in goodness. But just in case you are, I have one last prayer to you, sir. Help me never to feel again. And I don't want any special favors from you at all. I don't even want to feel good. Just help me never to feel again. With a whole lot of wood stove and a whole lot of whiskey, that prayer was answered. I left my parents' home, and I started living on the streets of Denver, Colorado, doing whatever a young teenage female alcoholic had to do on the street to get that next drink of alcohol. If that offends anyone in this room, I'm sorry. You know, but what I was helps make me what I am. There's nothing wrong with that. I feel like I'm a pancake. There's a flip side to it. I've got a Cinderella story. I had to have that side to have the side I have today. Had to have that side. The state of Colorado stepped in when I was 13 years old. And they said, young teenage girls don't live like I was living. And I thought, I don't know why not. And so they were going to punish me for being incorrigible. And they sent me to the reform school. Somehow or another, society has decided that reform schools are a bad thing, so we just let our kids do whatever they want to do now, I guess. I don't know. They never asked me about any of the decision-making processes. But I do know some children that went to reform schools that came out and had gotten over their behavioral problem. I went to this reform school to be punished. There was one person in a bed. And I'd never slept one person in a bed in my entire life. There was toilets indoors and a little silver thing you pushed and everything went away. And I thought, God, I love being punished. I got my first toothbrush in the reform school. It was not a bad deal. It was not a bad deal. I served my time and they let me go home. And I went home and I walked in my mother's home. In my entire life, I've never entered her doors without knocking. I wouldn't dare. And I knocked on her door, and I hadn't seen her. And I wanted my mama to be glad to see me. And she said, come in. And I walked in her house. I said, Mama, I'm home. And she said, yep, I know. And something inside of me just died a little more. And I said, Mama, I can't stay here. And she said, yep, I know. And I said, Mama, I'm running away. She said, yep, I know. She was a very enthusiastic female. And I left my mother's house that day, and I stayed on the streets of Denver doing whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. At the age of 16, the state of Colorado stepped in again, and they said, young teenage girls do not do the things that I was doing. And so they were going to commit me to the Colorado State Insane Asylum in Pueblo, Colorado. It was not a hospital. It was not a treatment center. It was an insane asylum. They did not recognize teenage alcoholism, so they had to come up with a diagnosis. Their diagnosis was that I was schizophrenic with paranoid reaction with psychotic tendencies. I had 8 years of sobriety before I knew what they'd sent me down for. My sponsor says schizophrenic means you're two-faced, and I am. Paranoid means you think people talk behind your back, and they do. And psychotic means I'd rather kill you than myself, and I would. With 23 years of sobriety, if somebody here has to get drunk, I want it to be one of you all because I have one shot at life in sobriety. One shot. In the Colorado State Hospital, the moment I walked into the admissions ward, it was a room almost this size. And it was lined with people. And there was a noise. And it's a noise of absolute total despair. A noise of, there was an odor of fear. Not the odor that you think of in a hospital. An odor of fear that went through the pores in my skin and consumed what heart I had. At the hospital, the psychiatrist decided that I needed 10 milligrams of Valium four times a day. I needed 25 milligrams of Librium four times a day. And I needed 50 milligrams of Thorazine four times a day. For 18 months, I didn't want to drink. The compulsion was removed before I ever heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. When I left the state hospital, I weighed close to 300 pounds. I could not get out into the sunshine. Three times a week for 18 months, they had administered electric shock treatment. Three times a week, I knew what powerless was. Three times a week, my soul died more and more and more. When I left there, I left in a shirtwaist dress, white anklets, and brown lace-up shoes. No teeth. My chin laid on the side of my chest. I'd lost the ability to talk. I had lost the ability to remember how to walk properly. I shuffled as I walked. I didn't shuffle out of desire. I just couldn't walk. I didn't know how to pick my feet up. And I had no voice left, but I had a sound. And that sound was with my head here, drooling, going, but see, if you knew how to hear that sound was still a plea. It was still a plea. I went back to my mother's home at the age of 18, and it was just a replay, and I left. And me, I thought it was the cutest thing that ever hit Colfax. The beer joints I went to, I think I was sometimes. I traveled via Greyhound bus or Continental bus all over the United States. And I'd get to a city and I'd find a beer joint. And I'd do whatever I had to do to stay drunk. And I did that for 10 years. And I wound up back in Denver, Colorado. And I wound up back on the streets. At this time in my life, I weighed 78 pounds. No teeth in my head. Still the cutest thing that hit the beer joints. See, alcohol was an answer to that prayer. I had no desire to ever change because I had no belief that there was ever anything any different. Where's a person like me go? Are you going to let your child sit at a table and eat dinner with me? Are you going to invite me to coffee after a meeting? Are you going to be able to sit across from me at a discussion meeting and not try to sit in the next chair so you don't have to touch my hand? Are you going to be able to listen to what my heart is saying that my mouth can't say? Are you going to be able to look beyond my behavior and see the nakedness of a soul that was wounded and ripped wide open from alcoholism? Are you going to be able to see beyond that and say, I care. I care. I don't know. A lot of people can't. I was sitting in a beer joint on October the 18th, 1969, and a gentleman and his wife came into the beer joint. They came in every Saturday night. He was in a wheelchair, and he told me she was, what's that word he called her? Al-Anon. I was used to men calling their wives a lot of things in a beer joint, but not an Al-Anon. I thought, poor baby, you know, what's that? He told me that they'd watched me for that year I'd been back in Denver, and they thought I had a problem with drinking. And I said, no, I don't have a problem drinking. He said, Cricket, you go places you don't remember going. And I said, I know that. He said, you do things you don't remember doing. And I said, I know that. He said, that's called a blackout. What's it matter what it's called? It's just part of the deal. I don't care. I don't care. He told me that I fought over stupid things, and I got real offended. I've never fought over, and 23 years later, I cannot think of one time in my life I've ever fought over anything stupid. Now, a woman in a beer joint walking up to me, calling me inebriated, to me that's a logical reason to fight. If she'd called me drunk and I knew what she was saying about me, I would have never hit her. But she called me inebriated, and I didn't know what she was talking about. So he informed me of a few things like that, and he said something about would I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with him the next evening. Just if I didn't have a drinking problem, it wouldn't hurt. And I said, okay, I'll go to a meeting with you. He said, well, do me a favor when you get up in the morning. Don't take that first drink of alcohol. I said, that's not a problem, big boy. And he said, okay, and then we'll go to a meeting of AA tomorrow night. I said, sure, no big deal. I woke up the next morning, did what I'd done for many, many years. I reached to the side of my bed, and I brought my whiskey up. And I set all 76, 78 pounds, I set up in the bed, and I brought it to my mouth. And for some reason that morning, I could not take that first drink of alcohol. Today, I realize that was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. I did not know that at that time. The man called about noon. Hi, this is Harry. Why do they have to be nice? I mean, why can't he just say, this is Harry? And I said, yeah. And he said, did you take a drink? I said, no, idiot. I told you I wouldn't. I haven't. Don't even want one, okay? You go into the meeting now. I'll be there. Do you need us to pick you up? I don't need anything from you, fool. You ask me to go to your meeting, I'll be at your meeting. Okay? Now, it's best just to leave me be. I felt nothing. I felt nothing. The week before I got sober, I sat in a restaurant, and a man got shot in the face right across the table, my escort, with a shotgun. And you know what made me angry? It got on my French fries. I was incapable, when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, of feeling anything. And I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous that night via the yellow taxi cab because I didn't need anything from these people. My very first AA meeting, and there was a red-headed woman, and she came charging down that aisle. There weren't a lot of women back in 1969. She was one of the three redheads. And she came up to me and she said, hi, my name's Sharon, are you an Alky? And I knocked her on her rear end. She didn't need to be speaking to me. I didn't speak to her. So what made her think she had a right to speak to me? And some of the men came over and they said to her, Sharon, have you told Cricket we care? And she said, not yet. She never did. After a while, they took theirs back. I stayed sober in Denver at the York Street Group. And I sat in the back of the room and I listened to Alcoholics Anonymous members sober members of AA. The little wicker baskets, they used to start them in the front of the room and they'd say, if you've got it, put it in. If you need it, take it out. Sit on the back row and let them tell you that. That's where the money's at. Okay? It's not up front. Wait till it gets clear to the back row and then take every folding dollar out of that basket. That's what they told you to do. And yes, I did need it. And so I took it. They told me to take what I could use now, what I couldn't use now, come back and get later. I took their adding machine. I took their typewriter. They didn't think it was funny at all. And see, they were really frustrated because AA has a thing called traditions, okay? They wanted to kick me out real bad. Really bad, but they couldn't because the traditions wouldn't allow them to if I had a desire to stop drinking. And you think I didn't know how to manipulate that one? I sat there and a bunch of men came up to me one evening. I had long-term sobriety about 3 days. And they said, Cricket, we need to talk to you. And I was ready for the talking, okay? I really wanted them to kick me out because I was lonely. I wanted to be back on my bar stool. I wanted to be back in my beer joint. I figured out their little first drink gets you drunk thing. It's the first drink that gets you drunk. I thought, I'll go to my beer joint. I'll order 2 drinks. He'll set them down. I'll dump the first one out. It'll never touch my lips. And then I will sue Alcoholics Anonymous. I believed it. I believed it. That made perfect sense to me. If I throw the first drink away and I never drink out of it and I get drunk anyway, I'll sue them. This group of men approached me. And they didn't have long-term sobriety. They parted the Red Seas in sobriety or something. They'd been sober that long back then to me. It seemed like forever. But they abided by the traditions. They, in spite of any feelings they had about me, they abided by the traditions. And what they told me was, Cricket, we're not going to put up with any more of your stuff. And I was delighted. And they said, we can't kick you out. And I felt such a keen sense of disappointment. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, our traditions won't allow us to kick you out. But we're not going to tolerate your behavior anymore. You may not turn over the coffee tables during a discussion meeting just because you don't like the discussion. You have to quit panhandling. You have to return the money you've taken. You have to pay to have the Coke machine repaired. You have to bring back the adding machine and typewriter, which was no big deal. They're not very pawnable anyway. And they told me these things. And they also told me that no longer could I wait until an Al-Anon walked in a room and run over and sit down on her husband's lap just to create trouble. And I had to have 2 escorts. And every night for 6 months, I'd walk to an AA meeting. 2 men would meet me at the door. They'd walk in. They'd sit down beside me. And then they'd leave. When I left, they'd walk me out. It lasted that way in Denver. I stayed sober 6 months. And I was approached by the narcotics division of the Denver Police Force and told I had to leave Denver. And I said, 6 months, I've done nothing. And you're telling me I have to leave Denver? And they said yes. And I said, okay, I will go on 3 conditions. Because, see, I asked them where I was going to go. And they said, Cricket, you're moving to Fort Worth, Texas. And I said, ooh, do you boys understand that I never went to Texas drunk? And sober, you're telling me I have to go there? And they said, yes, that's why. See, I had a real naive, stupid way of thinking. With outhouses, you did not have Charmin. You had newspaper and sometimes magazine pages. Texans used corn cobs, and I believed it. So I told these gentlemen that I would leave Texas on 3 conditions. I wanted a high school diploma, 3 cases of real soft toilet paper, and a car with a driver's license. I've never driven. I've never had a DWI. Maybe I'm not a member. I don't know. I think so, though. They took me to this building, and this lady read me of questions for about 15, 25 minutes, and she said, congratulations, you passed your GED. That was easy. They gave me a station wagon, and once again, the well-educated people, they give me a 58 Rambler station wagon. I've got 2 legs. It's got 3 pedals. It didn't make sense to me, and it never did. And I went down on a daily basis to take a driving test. And finally, I went in. One old cop went out with me, and he said, turn on the engine, because everyone else was refusing to get in that station wagon with me. And I turned on the engine. He said, you passed. And I said, God. And I went back in. I was so proud. And I heard him telling the other ones, as soon as we issue that license, she's heading for Fort Worth. So I get in that station wagon with my toilet paper and my GED, and I head to Fort Worth, Texas, just doing what I'm supposed to do. I'd done something to the gears or the block or something that car had that other cars don't have, that once I got to Fort Worth, it never went anywhere again. And I called my first meeting of AA, my first AA group in Fort Worth, Texas. And a man answered the phone, and I'm on the far east side of Fort Worth, and this is the far west, southwest side of Fort Worth. And he says, AA, may I help you? And I said, I need directions. And he said, where to? And I said, what do you think, idiot? From here to there. That's all I want from you. And so I hitchhiked to my first AA meeting in Fort Worth, Texas, and I walked in to Southwest Group, and this man's in the front, and here comes a red-headed Texan woman. She's really tall, and she walks up, and she starts to hug me, and she says, hello, darling. I was horrified, and I knocked her on her rear end. Just, you know, what right did she have? I stayed sober and practicing the principles in all my affairs at Southwest Group. Within 3 months, I had male escorts in and out of the meetings. See, I had a lot of preconceived notions about Al-Anon because of what the AA men said. And I felt real sorry for the AA men. I went to Harris Hospital. And I asked a man, I said, would you tell me where the intensive care unit is? He said, it's right behind that sign. So I waited till that man left, and I stowed the sign. And I went back, and I hung it on our Al-Anon room door that afternoon. See, the Al-Anons always, there's always a late AA and a late Al-Anon. Well, their room was, they had to walk through our meeting room to get to their door. And they all go in that Thursday evening, and nothing, you know, just bouncing. And they go in, and at 8 o'clock, they shut the door. Here comes the late Al-Anon, and she bounces up to the door, and she sees this intensive care unit sign. And the back of her ears turn red, and that's the only indication that something's wrong. And she opens the door, and she gives it an extra little thud when she walks in. About 3 seconds later, the Al-Anon comes out of that room. And her little nostrils are flared, and these veins are sticking out. And she looks around the room, and she says, who hung that sign? And I said, I did. And she said, oh, it's okay. What do you mean it's okay, lady? You know why? They were afraid of me. That's sad. That people were afraid of me, and that's the only way I knew how to communicate with people. If you were afraid of me, if you knew that I would hurt you, then everything would be okay. And they were frightened of me. Let me tell you about my God. I sponsor some Al-Anons today. Al-Anons have taught me how to do the computer. I've never done a computer. There's a whole lot of neat people but I listened to what one side told me. And I don't do that about anything or anybody anymore. You know, my brain's been restored. I have the capability of deciding for myself what's right or what's wrong for me. I stayed at Southwest Group, much to their despair, for 8 years, and I didn't take a drink. And I'd heard about this other group my entire length of sobriety in Fort Worth, called The Harbor. And I should never go to The Harbor Group, because I would never fit in. A woman like me, they would never accept. Those people were more intelligent, they were career-type people, and they would never accept me. Somebody got a resentment at Southwest Group, and they went over, and they poured gasoline all around inside, and they struck a match, and they torched it. My phone rang, people saying, "Cricket, where were you this afternoon?" I said, "Why?" "Somebody burned Southwest down." I said, "Is my name written in the ashes?" They said, "No." And I said, "Then I didn't burn the group to the ground." Because the law says I cannot be punished. Because of my mental record, I'm on a lifetime temporary release, which means unfairly, I can't be punished. It's a grave injustice to a real sick person to give them that kind of power. It's a serious, serious something those people that make those kind of decisions probably need to rethink about, because I ask them at the psychiatric review board, "You mean if I get angry and kill somebody?" And they said, "Well, you wouldn't be able to help yourself." You should have seen my list of "I can't help myself." Here you go, sucker. Whew. Thank God that when Southwest got burned, I went to that other group that would never accept me. And with 8 years of continuous sobriety, I walked into Harbor, and a red-headed woman came walking towards me. And she's taller, and she's an older lady. And she's got that skin that we get as God ages us. And I didn't want to hit this woman. I would have, but I didn't want to. And she came up to me and she said, "Cricket, my name's Betty G, and I'm real scared of you." And I thought, phew, I'm not going to have to hit her. And she said, "But I'm going to be your sponsor." "Number one, lady, I've got 8 years sober." She said, "I know that, and I won't take anything away from that at all. Number two, lady, you've got red hair." And she said, "I'll tell you what, let's go back in this little office and we'll talk. And if I think you understand the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I will leave you alone. I know you understand the fellowship. I know you understand sitting around listening in meetings and talking in meetings and holding hands and walking away. I know you know how not to take a drink. If I believe that you understand the program of recovery, I will walk away from you and leave you alone." And I said, "Okay, lady." And we went back in this little office at Harbor. And Betty G handed me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she opened it up. And she said, "Here, Cricket, read me the first portion of chapter 5. And I started reading to Betty G. Rarely have we seen a person fail, and I read and I read and I read. And she took the book away from me, and she said, "Cricket, you can't read." And I said, "Wait a minute, woman. I just read you the first portion of chapter 5. She said, "No, it was opened on chapter 3. And see, I've been married and divorced twice in AA. The first marriage, there was nothing honest about it. The man thought I could cook. I went to Mary's restaurant on a daily basis and bought food and brought it home and stuck it in that stuff women are supposed to use. He thought I was an excellent cook. There was no honesty anywhere on my part in that first marriage. God bless him." I asked her what she was going to do, because I'd kept that. Shock treatments took that ability away from me. These people that would never accept me, this group of people that were wealthier, better dressed, took me to TCU and introduced me to a lady that was in her late 70s, early 80s that was not alcoholic. And that woman said, I will teach you to read. And I said, how? She said, 26 things. 26 little things you have to learn. They're called the alphabet. Most of those things make one sound. Some of them make two. This letter is the letter A. It's going to go A or A always. It's never going to change. Day after day, I went to TCU with 9 and 10-year-old children, and this woman taught and taught and taught. And one day, she put a word up there. And just the way the traditions and the steps and the concepts are supposed to work, all of those joined hands, and they became a word. And it was a simple word. It may sound stupid to you, but it's still a big thrill to me. I looked at that, and it was the word bat. And I remember sitting there going, bat, bat. I know what a bat is. People hit balls with it. My neighbor ladies won. It's all kinds of things. It's a bird in a cave. You know, I know what a bat is. That's what the word looks like to that thing. And I knew. At that point, those people at that group set me in the coffee room down at Harbor. On a daily basis, Al-Anon and alcoholic, they taught me how to write. They taught me how to spell. They taught me how to print. They made me change the way I dressed. I could not wear clothes that gave a message that wasn't a true message about cricket. I could not act in a seductive fashion unless I meant to seduce somebody. And if I meant to seduce somebody, then go for it. But I didn't want to be like that. I wanted to be different from the inside out. They taught me how to eat with knives, forks, and spoons. They taught me how to take a bath like I was supposed to. I gave birth. And when I got home from the hospital with this little baby girl, I called my sponsor and said, Betty, they made me bring her home. And that baby's here with me. And she said, well, darling, that's what they do. And I said, but Betty, I'm going to hurt her. And she said, no. I said, yeah, you don't understand, Betty. I'm going to pick that little girl up, and I'm going to start hurting her, and I won't be able to stop me. I won't be able to stop me. I don't want to hurt her. But if I do, I'm not going to be able to stop me. Betty G, Mary Bell, Virginia, Flick, Tony, all came to my house. And they said, when your baby cries, you put her in her crib. If you can't do it, if you've got that feeling, and you walk outside. And let me tell you what they let me do one day. I put my baby's head here, and I put her butt here, and I looked at her. And I looked at her from in here. And last night in this room, I got to hold a little baby girl again. And the man wasn't afraid of me holding her. And that little baby girl wasn't afraid of me holding her. And see, I wouldn't have hurt that little baby girl. Because those people that never would accept me taught me I didn't have to be like that. Outside of cricket, with all that sobriety, had changed. Inside was that raging animal, that person, that thing. They took me at Harbor Group, and it was like I was a jigsaw puzzle. And those people down there, they took all of cricket, all of me, inside and out. And they cut my breastbone open, then they pulled it apart, and they took out the heart, and they dumped everything in the middle of that Harbor Group floor. Everything. And they started putting the puzzle together. And it's like they went to God, and they said, God, we can't do this deal. We don't know how, because people put puzzles together with the outside first. And we've got her okay on the outside. What do we do? And it was like God reached down, and he showed that group of alcoholics and Al-Anons, this is the piece you need to find first. It's the heart of cricket. I will take out of her her heart of stone and put in her a heart of flesh. She will be still and know that I am God. By these people that would not accept me. They taught me how to be a mother, because I didn't know how. They taught me how to work a legal job. Fred and I were laughing this morning. I got so excited with 9 or 10 years of sobriety because I had to pay income tax. I've never worked a job like that. The kind of jobs I worked for, your customers were all named John. They didn't do any withholding or Social Security. There wasn't insurance and all that. I was so proud. And I called IRS and thanked them. But you got to understand, that was a neat deal. That was a neat deal because God planted me in this country. I need to be a part of it. Okay? My daughter is now 15 years of age. And for a while, puberty was awesome. I never experienced that. But when I think, at her age, I'm in an insane asylum, being given drugs and electric shock treatment. Do you know what a thrill it is to be able to try to teach this child it's okay to say no? To drive a car, you have to do it the proper way. You have to take driver's ed. You have to pass a test. I'm not going to teach you to drive otherwise. How freeing it is to be able to give her rules and how free she feels because she knows her boundaries. My sponsor became very, very ill, and I took care of her. Now's the day to give back to your sponsor. See, my sponsor cried tears for me, said prayers for me, laughed for me, dressed me, taught me to mother, quit sponsoring anyone else while she sponsored me. I don't know why. And she loved me more than anybody in the whole world. And she never told me she loved me more than she did her own kids, but she did. I know she did. And she got so sick, and I got to go over and do her breakfast and her lunch and her dinner because my sponsor was an older lady. And I went over one morning to do that, and my sponsor had died. Let me tell you what happened the night before she died. I had gone back to this God before that, not long before that, and I said something to the effect, "Dear God, sir, this is Cricket. When I was 12 years old, I asked you to help me not to feel again." And that's prayer's answer. "See, sir, I go to those AA meetings and I can't stand those people to touch me. I don't want them to hug me. And when they do, I want to hit them. I don't care about them. If there's any way, sir, I'm way past 30 now. Could you help me feel again?" The night before my sponsor died, when I tucked her in bed, she looked up at me, and for the millionth time, Betty G said to me, "Cricket, darling, you know I love you." For the very first time, I looked into the eyes of a woman in her late 70s, early 80s, and her skin had aged with her eyes. But you know what happens? As the skin and the eyes age, the heart grows purer and purer and purer, and I believe that. And I traced a tear down her cheek. And I looked into her eyes and I said, "Betty G, I love you too." The last words I said to my sponsor was, "I love you too." When I found her, I knelt beside her and I wrapped my arms around her. And I thought, what do I do now? Those other people aren't going to like me. You know, this is my sponsor. what do I do now? The people from Harbor Group didn't go to see her son and grandchildren. They came to be sure I was okay. The calls came in for Cricket. Sympathy cards came for Cricket. At the funeral, my sponsor's grandchildren left the family row, went to the back row, and said, we're sitting with the one Granny loved best. I mean, because this woman knew how to love unconditionally. And that's been about 6 years ago. Let me tell you about my life. I've been married and divorced again. I'm a good mama. I'm a good mama. I'm a real good house cleaner. I'm still not a good cook. I don't know how. Betty didn't have time to teach me. And that's okay. I'm a good typist. I learned how to swim this summer. I'm 52 years old. And for the first time in my life, I learned how to swim. And I have my first pet. I have a cat. And it was given to me. And that cat likes me. I have friends. I have people who like me. And I can go places. And I've got places I want to go. I've got books I want to read. I've got songs I want to hear. And I want for you to touch me. And I'm not talking physical. See, I want your heart to touch my heart because there's still some healing. And the person that I care the most about in my AA group is not necessarily the newcomer. It's the one that looks untouchable, that behaves unacceptably because they don't know any different. And I like being bad. You know, I like going up and saying, if you don't knock that off, we're going to go outside and we're going to fight about it, and then we'll come back in and do the deal right. I don't mind that. You know, I don't mind getting on my knees in front of a human being. Not because I think anybody's any better than I am, but I know how magnificent my God is. And every time I get still, I know that He is. And I know that without my God, you wouldn't have been able to give me what you've given me. And do you realize what you've given me? Sobriety. Sanity. Cleanliness. You know, I'm clean. Dressing unoffensively. Being a good parent, being a good employee, being a good friend. How can I say thank you if I just bow my head before you and say, thank you. That's not enough, but that's all I can do. So thank you.